Hey listeners, if you're working on a manuscript, we'd love to help. Email us about our novel mentorship program at napleswritersworkshop@gmail.com. Welcome to Why Is This Good, a podcast by the Naples Writers Workshop. I'm Christine and I'm here with John. Hey, John.
Hello.
Okay, it's my turn. I picked a story by Kurt Vonnegut, and it's a series of numbers and letters, but it is pronounced to be or not to be.
To be or zero
yes.
to be.
Mm. Yes, it's to be or zero to be, but you'll learn from the story it's pronounced not.
Sounds familiar somehow.
Yes.
To be or.
Is it from something?
Not to be.
He saluted her and moved toward the door that led to the delivery rooms. Guess what was just born, he said. I can't, she said. Triplets, he said. Triplets, she said. She was exclaiming over the legal implications of triplets. The law said that no newborn child could survive unless the parents of the child could find someone who would volunteer to die. Triplets, if they were all to live, called for three volunteers. Do the parents have three volunteers? Said Leora Duncan. Last I heard, said Dr. Hitz, they had one and were trying to scrape up another two. I don't think they made it, she said. Nobody made three appointments with us. Nothing but singles going through today, unless somebody called in after I left. What's the name? Welling, said the waiting father, sitting up, red-eyed and frowsy. Edward K. Welling, Jr. is the name of the happy father-to-be. He raised his right hand, looked at a spot on the wall, gave a hoarsely wretched chuckle. Present, he said. Oh, Mr. Welling, said Dr. Hitz. I didn't see you. The invisible man, said Welling. They just phoned me that your triplets have been born, said Dr. Hitz. They're all fine, and so is the mother. I'm on my way in to see them now. Hooray, said Welling emptily. You don't sound very happy, said Dr. Hitz. What man in my shoes wouldn't be happy, said Welling. He gestured with his hands to symbolize carefree simplicity. All I have to do is pick out which of the three triplets is going to live, then deliver my maternal grandfather to the happy hooligan and come back here with a receipt. So I picked this one because I had accidentally picked a story that we had already read.
It's great.
Yeah, and it was one that a listener, well, I'll have to respond, because a listener wrote in and said, oh, if you like this story, you should definitely do this story next. And I was like, sure. And it was the Roald Dahl story, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I know we've done one by him before and we liked it, so we'll do another one. And as is common with my practice, I will just send something to John without checking. And that's what I did. I sent it to John without checking, and then John responded and said, we did this, you idiot. And it wasn't even that long ago.
Episode 99 is pretty long ago.
But it wasn't like episode 34.
That's true. That's
you know
true.
What I mean? It wasn't like the first year or whatever. It was recent enough memory that you think, I hope that had I started skimming it, I would have figured this out pretty quickly. So I found this Kurt Vonnegut story because I needed to scramble and find something. I forget how I found it, but I hadn't read it. And what I liked about it was how short it was and how much it gave you to think about regardless. You know, it's a type of sci-fi. You know, what happens in the future if the world has population control, and what would that look like in daily practice?
It's very much like Harrison Bergeron that we did before.
Yeah.
Where it's like, imagine the scenario in which this particular cultural norm or law or something has been applied and everyone's living by that, and what's going to happen. And here's a situation that arises because of that.
Yeah. And the scene that we're confronted with and the premise, you know, just the section that I read, it's a father having to figure out his triplets. But I found myself thinking about it after it ended, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Just what would the implications of this be? And the reason that there's population control, and it tells you straight off at the beginning and goes into a little more detail, details that they've figured out how to reverse and halt aging. And so
yeah.
The father in this waiting room is having kids for the first time at age 56, but it says he looks like he's 35. And so the average person is like 129. But if you want, you can live beyond that.
Like Mr. Hitz is like 200 and something.
Yeah. And there's people that want to live forever. There's people like the painter who I didn't feature in this section, but the story is happening in the waiting room here. And while this father is waiting to see his newborns, there's a guy that's painting a mural, and he's just got this negative worldview, and by the end he's like, yeah, I've had enough. But he's got the other attitude on all of this, just the horrible feeling of what it's like to just live and keep living, and for what? and then to have to decide to stop. And he's depressed, it seems like, and just has an attitude about all of this that other people don't seem to understand, because I think in a lot of ways we think that if we didn't die or age, there'd be no problems, right? It seems like the biggest problem is that we all have to die and get uglier until we do, you know? And if we could reverse all of that, you know, what's the issue? And the painter's like, there's still a lot going on here that I'm dealing with and that we should all be dealing with. We haven't solved anything. We've just created new problems for ourselves. So I found myself like really thinking about this. It felt like a concrete way to think about what a world like that would look like, because rather than just say we all get to live forever, it also introduced the next problem, which is how do we control the population so that the world can survive, everyone living longer? And if we're thwarting these natural processes, then humans have to step in and correct them. And the way we've decided to do it is just, it seems like horribly inhumane. And then it's like, oh, so if I was going to have kids in this world, I'd have to kill someone else that I love. What a selfish thing to think about.
Or talk to them into volunteering to be killed.
On the same day.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I felt like this was a really good example, and it's probably like my takeaway of some of the fastest world building that I've seen, where he just lays it out. He just says, it's the future. We've solved aging. And now the solution is population control, and this is how we do it. And now here's a scene in which it plays out specifically. And it still felt fully realized, even though it was done so quickly. It just threw you into it.
There was a couple of lines in the beginning that are just like, population is stabilized, old age is a distant memory, all this kind of stuff, just the basics. But then I think the best part of the world building is like, we get through the characters.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't outline that like anyone that's born needs to, there has to be a death in that beginning couple of lines. That comes in later as the characters are interacting with each other, as like discussion is happening, as far as I remember. I feel like that's one of the strength of why it was done so well. You give us the premises, and like what follows are the characters working out the consequences. It's almost like, I don't know how to put this other than, it's like a way to dramatize a syllogism, right? You have premise one, premise two, you dramatize the conclusion, the deduction that occurs because of those. But I think that's always the best way to do world building. It's like trying to tell somebody who doesn't know how to use a computer how to use a computer. You can't just tell them in the abstract. You have to sit them down in front of a computer and say, all right, now, this is how a computer works. You give them a couple of basic tips of how a computer works. Then you say, this is called a mouse. Move the mouse. Although nowadays it's not a mouse. You tap screens and stuff. But you know what I mean? Like, you have to like set up the groundwork, but then you have to get them to use it. You got to show it to them. And this is where classic show don't tell comes from. The best way to understand a world that you've built is to get us into the world and show it to us through characters interacting with it.
I guess I like that it's explicit until it, like you said, has us actually sit down and experience it through a character. It's like, why not just tell you what the concept of this world is? We don't need to meet the father in the waiting room and deduce from 3 pages of back and forth dialogue that this is the state of the world, you know?
Yeah.
It just gives it to us.
I mean, in the beginning, it's all diseases are conquered. So is old age. Death, barring accidents, was an adventure for volunteers. What a way to phrase that, by the way. But the population of the United States was stabilized at 40 million souls, which, when was this written?
Yeah.
What a number to stabilize at. But it's such a well done, just like groundwork, so that all the further development of those things follows from it naturally. Like, okay, that's the world we're in. We know that. Now we can watch these characters, and those characters reveal to us the nuances.
Right.
They reveal like those small things that you wouldn't put into the summary.
Right. And it's explicit in terms of Welling's situation, right? We know he's 56. We know he's about to have, like, it's just there. And then we quickly leave him. And then it's the scene in the waiting room of the hospital where the painter's working and the orderlies are walking around. And then we get to learn a little bit more about this telephone line, which is the title of the story, to be or not to be. And then you can call this and schedule your own death. And it's, you know, a type of euthanasia that they do. But they have all of these nicknames for the hotline.
Oh, that's the best part. Vonnegut gets so funny.
Yeah. Automat, Birdland, Cannery, Catbox, Delouser, Easy Go, Goodbye Mother, Happy Hooligan, Kiss Me Quick, Lucky Pierre, Sheep Dip, Warring Blender, Weep No More, and Why Worry? But to be or not to be was the telephone number of the municipal gas chambers of the Federal Bureau of Termination. So it's got to be gas chambers,
municipal,
too.
Even municipal gas chambers, right? Yeah. And just the snide comments here and there, the snark here and there. It's the characters themselves have those little moments.
Right.
Which, those are the kinds of little world building elements too. Like, they live in this world. Like, there is a shorthand for things. There's slang. There's like ways of deriding a person. Like, like, oh, you're one of those. You're somebody who kills people as your job. Like, you're going to refer to them in a certain way. And he does it in a snide way, right?
Yeah. And to your point about it being world building, rather than tell us what it might feel like, we can just meet these characters immediately who have lived in this world for some time and they've developed their entire attitude about it, right?
They have the attitude, they have a perspective on things.
Yeah.
They have feelings about it that are represented by the way they interact with it.
And I would have to, I don't have a play-by-play of how my own thoughts on it were developing, but I do know that it was immediate to then see the painter after all of this is built up and to see the painter with just this chip on his shoulder and to realize pretty quickly that this would be a pretty pervasive attitude. The idea that while we've solved population control, the consequence is not just that we have to decide who dies. It's also that the government is going to be in charge of all of this stuff. You know, we've given up a lot of our autonomy to these rules and procedures that we've agreed are necessary and right to keep all of this in check. And it's just, these people are the doctor and the woman that comes in to get memorialized on this mural. She's the one that makes people comfortable in the gas chambers, like, and who they schedule appointments through when they've decided to die. Like, the doctor and this woman, they just have this permanent smile plastered on their face, and you can't help but wonder, are they really getting it? You know, the painter seems to have a real pulse on this. And then the father to the triplets, we don't know what he's thought about life in this world up until this point, but you get the sense that he's been cool with it until he was faced with the very real reality of how do you welcome new life without saying goodbye to the old. You know, he's feeling like just desperate. But the painter doesn't seem to have any skin in the game, and he, you know, we don't know about his family, we don't know if he has kids, we don't know what he's dealing with right now, except that he just does not like how this is going down. And so it feels like a really good way to just get into a range of the attitudes immediately too. It's not a story in which we're holding the hand of a character who's learning about this world. It's not told through the eyes of a child. It's not told as the world is developing this set of rules. You know, we're just thrust into it and then we just get to see immediately.
Mr. Whaling, he has been living a life where he's not forced to confront this decision.
Until,
right?
Yeah.
And this is the moment where that decision is like just blithely moving through this world. Like, he and his wife, prior probably girlfriend, were just enjoying a life where you don't have to worry about dying. You're just healthy.
Yeah.
You're just living it. And then all of a sudden, she's having triplets. And now he is like, okay, now I have to confront the reality here.
Right. Yeah, you have to confront the reality. And also, it's almost like the ultimate consequence. He's been living without worry. And now here is all the worries of all the world on your shoulder all at once, right? When you've like eliminated the idea that like you're not going to die, you have all the time in the world to accomplish things, to experience things, to live a full and rich life. And then it all comes crashing down like the day that it's supposed to get better for you, because it's only then that you've had to consider any of it at all.
They were only able to get one volunteer. And so like, how much did they look? You know, that day of the birth is like, it's approaching,
months.
It's approaching.
Yeah. Right.
Do they even have 9 months? Like, I mean, this wasn't in the story, but like most multiples come early.
Yeah.
And even, we don't even find out about that until like how far into the pregnancy when they do scans and stuff. I mean, the technology is not specified here, but you can imagine, but it's a short amount of time. It's like you're living 200 years.
Yeah.
A couple of months is not very long.
Right.
How seriously are they doing the search until like, here's the day that has to happen. And now you're like, now I have to pick one of the kids to survive because I only have one guy. Yeah. This is a Vonnegut story through and through, by the way. Like, think about his thoughts about World War II and like,
yeah,
everything else he's written.
Yeah. So it goes. Yeah. I think we've talked about this a lot. Anytime we've touched on a sci-fi story, and I've said it a lot, the idea that sci-fi was not something I thought I cared about or wanted to read until we started doing a lot of these short stories. And it's because I think a lot of these short stories are character-driven versus plot-driven, you know? And this, I think, is another really good example of something that, you know, maybe on the surface feels pretty plot-driven because it is so explicitly laying out the world for us and giving us this premise and this one way to experience this world with this conflict that's arisen. But like I said, I was thinking so much afterwards about what would it be like to just know that you get to live forever. And it is so character driven then that way, because you're introducing just this universal thought, which is that it sucks that we have to die. And then it's like, well, here's a way where you don't have to, and it still sucks.
One of the brilliances about this presentation is there's four characters interacting in this room, basically four characters in the story. And he picked four characters that represent four different perspectives on what the situation that's being dramatized here is, you know, picking who's going to die when someone's born. And there's Mr. Hitz, you know, runs this whole facility, came up with stuff. The woman who performs the stuff, the painter who has perspective on things, the guy who has, who's confronting the situation in the moment,
right,
they all have different perspectives, and that's what lets you get this rounded view on everything. So the obvious advice based on that is, like, when you're exploring an idea in fiction, it's like you got to pick the right characters. This character has to come from that point of view, and this character, and then you smash them together and see what happens, right? And that's how you get interesting dynamics.
Yeah, and it's what makes someone like me, who's not interested in the plot of sci-fi, invested in the plight of these characters, because they're experiencing like a very human problem just through this lens. And like you said, he's picked the cast so perfectly that I can read something that's only 8 pages and feel like I've experienced the range of perspectives on this problem, this conundrum. Yeah.
Pairing them off too, like having, she talks to the painter briefly, and then she talks to Mr. Hitz, and then like Mr. Welling shows up, like the way that they're all introduced and brought in allows differently shaped conversations to happen.
Right.
So you get different, like, you wrestle with a different issue in each version of that.
Right.
All because of the characters you've picked and their approach.
Right.
So it's a complex dance. It's one of those things where I feel like you can do it in a bunch of different ways as a writer, but like you could plan it all out. Like, I need this character, I need this perspective, I need this. Or you can just, like, as it's flowing, you say, you know, we haven't addressed this aspect yet. I need a character to do that. So you introduce that character. Like, however it comes out, you have to find a way to figure out which characters are necessary to get the right dynamics into your exploration.
It makes me wonder if like Vonnegut did that actual work, or if he just is like, he just seems to like embody this attitude about the world in general, that it just plays out.
Some writers, I feel like it's intuition. He's like, just felt like it was right. And the ending of the story, however we want to give away, he's got to kill 3 people.
Yeah.
So he needs at least 3 people in the story.
Uh-huh.
And then you have that fourth one for the other thing, for the next bit of it. So.
Yeah. And like you said, the perfect cast of characters has given us a perfect range of opinions and attitudes about this world and how it operates. But they've also just, it feels almost like a stage play, because everything is so dramatically that character, right? Dr. Hitz is so exuberant and positive. They describe him as 7 feet tall. He's this big, happy presence that's just imposing.
Another thing that made me think of Harrison Bergeron. It's like, Vonnegut's got this thing for like 7 feet tall people.
He's like, that's the ideal height.
Yeah.
In the future, we're all 7 feet tall and there's only 44 million of us. But yeah, so like the doctor is just larger than life, and then the painter, he just seems to have this like, he's like super negative, and the father is super hopeless. Everything he says in the section that I read, he's just got such an attitude. He's like, present, the invisible man, I'm so lucky.
He's glum.
Yeah, and it's just like so over the top, and that feels sort of Vonnegut, right? But that's also one way to kind of do it, is to make everyone,
you just tweak them that little extra.
Like turn the dial up on all of that and make it that much more obvious, so that they're that much different from each other and they stand out. And it's also, I think, that larger than life part is also what lends to sort of the overall sort of chipper attitude of this story. So, you know, it ends in double murder suicide, and then the painter signs up to also go and die that day, because he's like, you know,
well, that
what
sucks.
Yeah, he's like, I really don't feel like finishing this mural, and this has been a wild day, so I'm all done. But I didn't read this story and feel despair so much as I'm glad the world doesn't work this way. And there's something about like the larger than life aspect that makes it easy to experience what is otherwise extremely tragic, because we've come at it in a way that's I'm trying to think of the word, like, what is it when it's like exaggerated, when it's
hyperbolic?
Yeah, sort of. There's a level of this that lends almost humor and levity to it, because it's so sort of far-fetched and outrageous, not just the premise and the plot, but you know what I mean? Like, it's I don't know what I'm trying to say, except that
it's like farcical.
Almost. It's like satire, like, in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's satiric in certain ways.
Yeah, but that feels like uniquely Vonnegut too, where he can write about the war left and right, and if I pause in the reading of some of his stuff, I can despair briefly, but then it's just sort of on to the next, and the characters are just sort of humming along. And I think it's because when something is so devastating and terrible, that's how humans cope, you know, is with some kind of sarcastic edge that makes everything feel a little more bearable. Or else someone like the painter, who you could argue maybe feels the most negative about it. The dad, as we've at least thought of him or described him, hasn't maybe had to deal with this reality until this point. But the painter seems to have had this mentality for a long time. He would have killed himself a long time ago, except that he's developed some way to sort of cope, and it has everything to do with like how he presents and characterizes his thoughts on it, right? So there's something about that whole, how it's just overblown. If you're gonna write a short story and it is really, really, really sad and devastating, one way that you could probably do this is to just make everyone that much more dramatic. And then the satire just seems to come with it. It's like part and parcel then when things are so overblown. We know this is like a caricature of an individual in a situation.
Yeah, they're funny too, just the way they talk to each other. Vonnegut's humor comes through.
Yeah, the painter is really negative, and still when he's talking, I'm like, this guy's kind of funny.
This guy's great.
Yeah, because he's talking to the nurse. He's like, is that where you want to be? Like, you want to be, is this the body you want?
Denigrating.
The whole time. And like, even the nurse is kind of oblivious to it. It doesn't penetrate it for her, yeah. Because while the painter has developed this sarcasm that gets him through, the doctor and this woman have developed what they call, like, you know, toxic positivity. This optimism that has nothing to do, it's just completely devoid of reality, and that's how they get through, by not confronting it ever.
The painter almost feels like an everyman kind of guy in this. He's the everyman of this world. Like, yeah. You gotta live in this dumb world. And so he makes the snide comments like, oh, you're the person who kills everybody. Great.
Right.
You're a wonderful, helpful member of society.
Right.
Doesn't respect it, but has that kind of like, I'm expected to respect it.
Yeah.
But I'm gonna make fun of it because I don't. I think it's ridiculous. I'm gonna ridicule it.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there's any danger in this world of sort of defying, you know, like explicitly having an attitude that you don't like how this goes. Because it doesn't matter. You're part of it. You have no say. So like a painter like that, they don't even worry that he's like working in that hospital. He's like, what are you gonna do about it? Kill yourself and everyone else?
I'm sure that there's some, it's obviously not a focus of the story, but there must be some enforcement mechanism. You can't just walk out of the hospital with your three kids and say, no one's dying.
Right. Yeah, because like they said, he's like, oh, they were just born. And she's like, oh, that's weird. We only have one death scheduled. And neither of them is really worried about how they're gonna come up with the other two. They know that it'll just get solved.
It'll happen. And it did.
Yeah, gosh. It's really messed up.
My takeaway was basically that thing we were talking about at the beginning, the world building stuff.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about it in terms of show and tell.
Yeah.
And how at the beginning, he tells us these baseline things, and then he uses those as a way to show us the rest of it, the nuances.
Right.
And so this story does a great job. If you pull it apart, you can figure out these are good ways to think about when to tell and when to show. Like, you can tell us certain things and then show us other things based on those things. It's a great guide for that, I think.
Yeah, you can tell in the interest of saving time and words and space, and then you can show what needs to be dramatized and felt, right?
It's you save the time and the space because it's so unimportant.
Yeah.
It's got to be established as a baseline fact, but it's not something we got to spend a lot of time on. We don't need a scene that demonstrates that there are only 40 million Americans and its population is held at that place. Just tell us.
Yeah.
And we'll figure out the rest later.
Right, because this story is not about suddenly living in a world that plays by these rules. It's about characters that are faced with the reality for the first time of living in, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, the consequences.
Yeah, yeah, it's about the consequences, not about like how we decided to arrive at this place or how it was developed or else. Then seeing and seeing some of this world building would be a totally different story.
Yeah, it's not like we need to watch the parliament come up with the idea.
No, it's like when Hagrid tells Harry, you're a wizard. It's like, okay, thanks, we saved a little bit of time here. Like, you know, at first it was kind of weird, but now we know. We don't have to spend three more books with Harry figuring what that's like.
It's like, you're a wizard, but now we're going to figure out what the nuances are.
Yeah, there's some weird things that happen before then, which are kind of fun and exciting. But yeah, no, we're just saving time. We're cutting to the chase so that we can get into the meat of the actual story. Yeah.
That might be a good way to think of it, because it's about proportion, right?
Yes.
You tell us things that are small, that don't matter to the story. You just have to establish, and you show us things that need a larger proportion because they're more important.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes people that specifically write sci-fi or are into sci-fi, I think, are so enamored by the plot and the intricacies of the world that they've decided to build that, like, they forget that that's not a story.
Yeah. I was going to say about these characters was that we already talked about it, but the characters, because they offer different perspectives, the world building that you show is the world building that comes from the conflict between the characters.
Right.
That's the world building that emerges by being shown. It's like where things are wobbly. But all the characters agree on what he's told us. They all agree that the population is this. We all live in a world where old age isn't a thing anymore. anymore, where right. volunteer to die. You tell us that because everyone lives in that world. There's no conflict about that. What comes up in the conversations and what gets shown to us as world building is where the conflict is.
It's like the metaphor that you gave before of like showing someone how to use a computer and then actually using it. It's like, here is the premise in practice. And it's only in practice that we get to see, well, how does this really work?
Yeah.
And that's when the characters start to butt up against each other. They're all playing by these rules, but none of them really want, like, you know, they all have an opinion about the rules. So thanks, guys.
That's how you end it.
If you enjoyed this episode, consider joining our Patreon. Your support helps us keep the show running. Find out more at patreon.com/whyisthisgoodpodcast. You can also subscribe to our monthly newsletter at napleswritersworkshop.com.